If you love all things gardening, why not join us at our Spring Fair from the 3rd to the 5th of May at Bewley in Hampshire? You'll find everything you need to kickstart the season. Find out more at bbcgardenersworldfair.com. See you there.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by the Inspire Collection by Kalia. Just because you're working out doesn't mean you shouldn't look fabulous. The Inspire Collection by Kalia was designed with both style and performance in mind. It looks good, feels good, and stays put no matter how you move. And the collection has everything you need for a day at the gym. A support bra, crop tanks, bike shorts, amazing leggings, and more. It's their most versatile collection yet. Shop the Inspire Collection by Kalia now, exclusively at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello and welcome to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast, brought to you by the team here at the magazine. Join us as we chat all things gardening with the nation's favourite experts.
Are you taking the right steps to boost your health and well-being? Could one of the best solutions be found just outside your back door? As the COVID pandemic throws the spotlight on our nation's health, we're investigating what role gardening can play. Hello, I'm Lucy, and welcome to today's episode. And to help uncover the benefits of being an active gardener, who else to ask but Monty Don, a longtime champion of gardening's restorative powers, plus, of course, the nation's head gardener as lead presenter of Gardener's World, and a regular contributor to the pages of our magazine on these very issues. Today, you'll hear from Monty how gardening has helped him through some darker times, and why he's optimistic about the future. But first, I asked him, how does gardening make him feel?
Well, that's a very simple and a very complex question, or at least a simple question, a complex answer. Because by and large, I don't think about how it makes me feel. I just feel how I feel, and therefore I don't deconstruct it. So it's the serious answer is, how does gardening change the way I feel? Or how does it stop me feeling certain things? So that if I am in any way under par, either anxious or depressed or just feeling bowed down by the weight of the world, then gardening is, above all else, is the thing that removes that. And it is replaced with, I suppose the trendy word would be mindfulness. In other words, a total immersion in the present. And as any gardener knows, you know, that might be wet, it might be cold, it might be boring, it might be repetitive. But the point is, because it's always part of a bigger picture, it puts the whole world in perspective on one level. So if you're weeding a border, you don't necessarily want to do the weeding, the hand weeding, and it's a bit muddy and it's a bit sticky and the rain is starting to come. But you want the border to be weeded and you know it's part of a plan. And without ever consciously thinking it, I think that that sets your mindset into other problems in life. You know, okay, there is this thing that's not good, or I'm feeling pretty crappy today, but it'll pass, or even perhaps more relevantly, there's a reason for it, and that's fine. You know, that's okay. That's part of the state of things. And I think that most of our mental health problems, which is really what feelings come down to, are to do with not seeing the bigger picture or not putting yourself in a bigger context, either becoming over burdened with your own problems or bound up in your own world. And anybody who has ever dealt with depression certainly knows that one of the features of it is solipsism, is this sort of hugely unhealthy self-centeredness. And you're aware of it, but you can't control it. So anything that gets you out and puts you in context and with weather, with earth, with plants that have a timescale, is a leveler. It's a balancer out. That's a very long answer to a very simple question. I'm sorry.
But no, it's a great place to start. And I guess, you know, we can go sort of right back to your first experiences, I suppose, and ask, you know, did you always know it was going to be gardening?
No,
you know,
well,
how does it differ to other activities? Was there anything else it could have been?
No, I didn't always know it was going to be. I was born into a household with a large garden. We had a 5-acre garden in Hampshire, which my mother inherited from her father and her father inherited from my grandfather, who built a house in a field in Hampshire in the 1870s. So by the time I arrived on the scene, it was established. It was where we lived. It was, and at a very early age, the regular help we had in the garden, he hurt his back, and that was it. So we didn't have any more, and there was no other help. So from about the age of 7, me and my brothers, and it wasn't just me, it was very much a family thing, we were all dragooned into gardening. And it was a question of dragooning. I mean, there was no question, there was absolutely no question of, you will learn to love this, or this is fascinating, or look at that plant, isn't it wonderful? It was mow that lawn, clip those edges, turn that compost, weed these things. And we did it as part of the household chores. I mean, it was absolutely in line with feeding the chickens, with taking the dogs for a walk, with chopping wood, with doing the washing up, with cleaning the cars, making your bed, you know, all the things that most children experience in some form or other. And I did it in that spirit until I was about 16, 17. But by then, by default, I'd actually learned quite a lot of gardening. I'd done a kind of rather brutal apprenticeship. And it wasn't creative gardening. There was nothing creative about it at all. But for example, I absolutely knew how to run a vegetable garden. I knew how to make compost. I knew what was a weed and what wasn't a weed. I knew how to prune various things. There were the mechanics of gardening and none of the poetry. And this is something I've often written about and talked about, but I had a sort of Damascene moment when I was 17, when I was... I'd been expelled from a couple of schools and I was sort of a fairly feckless youth, you know. I mean, in a way that in the early 70s, I tried very hard to be. And I came home from my new school, which is a day school, and got home, made a cup of tea and did what by then was natural, which was go outside to do some gardening, do my bit for the household. And it just happened that March day, I decided to sow some carrots. And we were brought up, it was Hampshire, very chalky soil, very thin chalky soil. And I can remember very clearly preparing the soil. And it was one of those early spring evenings, so late afternoons, when you just start for the first time in the year to feel some warmth. And you take your jersey off, you know, you roll up your sleeves and you just feel some sunshine on you. And you can see some midges, you know, in the air. And there's a real sense, although you know there could be snow and ice, spring is absolutely on its way. And I remember preparing the ground and drawing a drill and pouring the seed in my hand and suddenly being overwhelmed by a moment of really what can be described as bliss, in the sense that, I mean, I can intellectualize it because at the time I didn't at all, but it was the absence of desire. It was the complete absence of desire because I had everything I wanted. In that moment, I had everything I ever wanted. And not just in a sort of colloquial way, I mean literally. I could have died at that moment and I would have died a happy person because life was complete. Well, that was pretty unexpected. Came out of the blue. I thought, you know, that's a strange thing. And that night I had a dream where, and as I said, I've often talked about this, I put my hands in the ground and my fingers grew as roots. And, you know, deep, 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 deep into the soil. And I woke up feeling very refreshed and happy and content. And ever since then, I mean, clearly it's a metaphor, but ever since then, by getting my hands in the soil and through the process of nurturing the soil and nurturing plants, I nurture myself. And I, you know, we can trivialize that by saying it's my happy place, or we can, as I prefer to do, say I found in that moment the absolute sweet spot, the moment of truth. You know, it was the one thing that I mainlined into. Now, you know, it was much more complicated than that, because if this was a novel, I would give up everything. I would have applied to horticultural college and I would have become a gardener and lived happily ever after. It wasn't like that, because back in 1971 or whenever it was, gardening was still a chore. It was still something I did for the household. But there was something in it for me for that. For the first time, I was getting something from it. And that's never gone.
Extraordinarily revelatory at such a young age. Yeah. And having had actually relatively a sort of brutal introduction to it. I mean, yeah. I know I've read you. I mean, I think it'd be fair to say your mother
was
quite formidable.
She was old school in a very, I mean, and in fact, I met someone the other day, my age, who I grew up with, but sort of hadn't seen for 50 years. And we were talking about our childhood. And he said, boy, your parents were something else. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, they were famous for being strict and old-fashioned. And we're talking about the late 50s, early 60s, when everybody was strict and old-fashioned. You know, I mean, they were really, truly Victorian. Which, of course, when you're on the receiving, well, I mean, I say receiving end of it as though it's all bad. There were good things about it. You know, it wasn't devoid of love. It was just strict, really strict. You're unaware of it because that's life. You know, that's everything. Yeah.
But it must have shaped your relationship with gardening. So, you know, it's sort of extraordinary that you came out of it relatively young. You're still in your teens and thinking, actually, gardening is something very positive, because you had this
very strict, formal training. Confusing, because we now really encourage young gardeners, or at least I hope we do. I hope anybody listening to this who's sort of under 25 feels that they are wanted and welcome and you know, they are our future. We now sort of, you know, there are people winning gold medals at Chelsea in their 20s and things. Back in 1971, 72, I literally didn't know another human being that was interested in gardening other than my two brothers. Nobody of my age had any interest whatsoever. And also gardening in the media and also in commercially simply wasn't geared to people who didn't have access to gardens or didn't own their own garden. I mean, it was a grown-up activity in every sense of the word. Unless you were a sort of botany geek or something like that, and there was that way in, but that, I was never that. It was gardening that I liked, growing things, not that's how I came to gardening through soil, not through plants. And that was what was unusual about my interest. But it wasn't really until I met Sarah that I met a kindred spirit who I could even talk to about this. I mean, what it did enable me to do was that through my student years, I worked as a gardener to earn money. So, you know, I went and worked for 6 months in a garden in France. All the time I was at university, every Saturday during term time, there was one garden in particular I used to go and, you know, very ordinary stuff, dig their garden, mow their lawn, cut their hedges. This was not glamorous. This was not working in the botanic garden. But I had the confidence to do that. I felt completely comfortable doing that.
But it was a solitary pleasure or solitary pursuit. And I feel that possibly, did that change when you met Sarah or at another time? When did it flip for you from being that solitary inner world to maybe something outer?
Well, do you know, I don't think it ever has. That's the truth. I think that gardening is most important to me as a solitary activity, which said somebody who's on television speaking to millions of people every week. And, you know, I've always said, slightly provocatively, because you know me well enough to know that occasionally I can be like that.
You, provocative.
you know, I am an amateur gardener. And what I mean by that is I am proud and want to preserve my independence from any kind of profession or institution. I garden primarily for myself and my family. Now, meeting Sarah was wonderful because it was a kindred spirit. It was someone who I could speak the same language, and we very quickly, we would go and visit gardens together. That was something we did in our 20s. But again, nobody else did. You know, in the 80s, certainly the early 80s, how many 23, 24, 25-year-olds were systematically visiting National Trust gardens? Not many. We never. And if they were, they weren't there the same day as us, I can tell you. You know, I often joke saying that we lowered the average age from down to about 70. But it's true. The average age of the garden visitor in the 80s when we were going was the age I am now or older. And so we then became a little team, and we had our garden in London that we loved. And we worked really hard, and we started a business. So we didn't have a lot of time for at least half the year. But the half the year that we could garden, which was pretty much sort of March through till October, November, we spent every spare minute in it. And our great thing were Sundays, we never left the garden. You know, we would, and the garden and the house would be a complete tip, and there'd be wheelbarrows in the kitchen and all this sort of thing. We never shared that. I mean, it was not a communal thing. It was ours. And then we would go out into our fashion world, and we never talked about the garden because there was no one to talk to. You know, we weren't being secretive. It was a bit like that if somebody now, I don't know, had a passion for ice hockey or lacrosse, say, which are perfectly respectable, good things to do, but just not widely shared. You know, it was the same idea.
Yeah, yeah. You've written a lot, actually, about that sort of clear relationship between a healthy gardener and the health of the gardener. And I wondered if, do you look back and see each of your gardens as a sort of reflection at the time on your state of health? Is that too trite to say?
Yes,
to think
it is,
of
Lucy. I think, well, certainly when we were at Hanbury's, when I wrote The Prickety Bush, a chaotic, slightly manic, destructive garden. Wonderful. I mean, it was an extraordinary thing. It was a young man going berserk in a garden, which was rather a wonderful thing, really. You know, it had a kind of heroism about it that was destructive. But there you go. So yes, I see that. I haven't made that many gardens. I mean, we made the London garden, which was good. I look back at pictures of it and I think, yeah, that was a good piece of work. You know, it was good. Sarah and I have, and it's really important that it is always Sarah and I, have always been very comfortable with being ambitious, with taking on difficult problems that, you know, we've bought houses that are complete ruin. And we think, oh, that's interesting. And other people, I mean, we have a great friend who lives in Papua New Guinea. And she came, and you know, and I've actually written about, so I can talk about it. We have a small farm in the Black Mountains in Wales, which we bought 15 years ago. And it was a ruin, a real ruin. And we had this friend who had come over from New Guinea, and we see her about once every 5 years and said, look, you must come and see this fabulous thing we've got. And it's wonderful and it's beautiful and it's so exciting. And she looked at it and she almost burst into tears saying, what are you doing? You know, you're insane. This is a disaster. And all we saw was just this fabulous opportunity. And I think, if there are two of you, you can do that. If you're entirely on your own, it takes a lot more. So, and Sarah and I think I've said this to you before, we have this basic principle in gardens and in houses that we both have a veto. So we both have to agree in order to do it. And if one doesn't agree, however badly the other wants to do it, it can't happen. And the beauty of that is A, it means that you agree. And B, you have to argue your case. You know, if you really badly want to do it, what's stopping it? What's the problem? Why isn't it happening? So you have to stand back and say, okay, there is clearly a problem here. Let's try and resolve it. I want this to happen. How can I make it happen? It's not going to happen by bullying. So I need to persuade or reason or change my view. You know, I need to come out. And it's a very good life lesson, actually, that from gardening, because we have this about every plant almost, if you're negotiating at all, you've got to find out what the other person wants rather than make them have what you want. And until you do, it's not going to happen. Or at least it's not going to succeed. It's not going to last. And that's entirely from gardening, really, you know, with somebody else.
And the ambition is great because ambition sounds like it's a time where you're feeling very positive. You can't be ambitious when you're not
No,
at your
I think
best.
If you're depressed, I mean, if you're clinically depressed, obviously you don't do anything, or at least you do everything badly. I mean, in my case, my form of depression is not sort of catatonically staying in bed and for weeks. It's just sort of everything getting worse. says he roaring with laughter. It's just almost literally everything getting worse. Your health, just sort of how you do things, what you do, your relationships. Life becomes a downward spiral. And the worst thing about it is you're aware of it. This is not, you know, you are doing it. And you are aware that it is harming everybody else and you, and yet you go on doing it. And so that becomes a part of it. I have found for myself, I mean, that there are a lot of things that are helpful. One of the great things that has been really helpful is traveling and seeing other gardens and being with other people and the discipline of travel. Someone says, call time is 7:30 or the bus is leaving at 6 in the morning and you have to be there. So you just have to be there and that's that, you know. Or you are interviewing somebody and this is their name and this is what it's about. And you're thinking, you know, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to ask. Or even more seriously, I don't care. I don't care about you. I don't care about your garden. I don't care about television. I don't care about books. I don't care. But you have to pretend to care. And actually pretending to care is quite a good way of really caring. You know, it's cognitive therapy. And for me, getting out into the garden at any level, I mean, literally putting my boots on and walking into the garden is a step in the right direction. I mean, I've said this before, we have chickens and they're at the end of the garden on a really grim December day. If you're feeling bad, physically walking to the end of the garden and feeding the chickens and walking back is not much of an achievement, but it's actually quite important because you've had to go outside. You've had to look after something other than yourself. You've had to do it at a time when they want it, not when it suits you. And you are reconnecting. There is weather and there is light and it's pretty minimal, but it's something. And it's the same in the garden, you know.
And you're bringing in there, you know, one thing I think is so important in terms of our relationship with nature and our gardens, which is the seasons. Yeah. It's constantly changing. I have no idea how life would be. I couldn't imagine life without the seasons that we have, you know. So we're so lucky in this country, I think, that we have that. And that, I think, for you is important because I know how tough winter is, in particular for you.
I am very, very responsive to light on a macro and a micro level. So I love waking up when it's light. You know, I would never have curtains in any bedroom I slept in. I want the light streaming in at dawn. And in winter, on a a macro level, when it goes, then I certainly go too. And I would very happily decamp sort of the end of October to somewhere where there was sunshine. I don't care about heat. I mean, I'm quite happy for it to be cold. But I would much rather have some light, yeah. I find northern skies are tough.
But you're here very often, I know. I know obviously there's often a chance to escape, but you are here. So what is getting you through at that time? I mean, you mentioned feeding the chickens.
It's partly to do with this garden. If we have years like last year, it's so wet here and so sort of unconducive to gardening. I mean, there are jobs that have to be done. You know, there are leaves to be collected and plants to be put away and tulips. One of the things actually, it sounds trivial, but a really important thing that matters to me is all the bulbs and pots, for example. I mean, as you know, I have help in the garden here, and I couldn't possibly do it without help. But I very, very rarely delegate planting. I like to do as much of the planting as I possibly can, which is 90% of it, because it's important to me. It's that old thing of the soil, you know. And tulips in November are really important, and it's what you were talking about. It's season, so A, it's getting out, doing it. And as you know, we grow a lot of tulips in pots, so there are thousands to be planted up. It takes days and days. And we have to prepare the soil, and you get the grit, and you sieve it, and you know, leaf mold. It's a palaver involved. And then there's that thing is, okay, now we want to see you grow. So it's November, and it's grey, and there is December, which is going to be even greyer. But it won't be long before those shoots appear, usually about the end of January, early February. And actually, I really get huge pleasure from all our early bulbs, very early irises we have that start to appear by mid-January. So for me, once you get to Boxing Day, you get Christmas out the way. and I'm actually not a screw. I like Christmas. I'm very happy with Christmas, but I don't like, I'm unhappy up till Christmas Eve. You know, I really dislike it. It's really bad. But then we have Christmas, and that's family, and I like that, and I like the cooking, and, you know, it's lovely. And then on Boxing Day, I sort of feel, okay, right, let's get to grips with you. Enough of this. I'm not going to be beaten. I'm not going to be ground down by you lot anymore. It's time to fight back. And, you know, I mean, that's it. It's still dark at 5 o'clock and it's still cold and miserable, but there are things to do. And it's really important to me that, you know, I always sow chilies in early January, and if I haven't, I always sow some more sweet peas. And so I'm sowing and I'm preparing seed compost, and I'm just things are getting going. Things are starting. And that's, so it's only really those 2 months. I used to find October very difficult, but I seem not to anymore. It seems to be getting better. I think it's because I travel more. You know, I just get away more. I spend a lot of time on my own. You know, I write on my own, this desk. I, as I just said, I garden on my own a lot. I take the dogs for a walk on my own. I would say I spend at least half of my waking hours on my own, and the other half to greater extent with the family or whatever. But by far, my sort of most social time is on a shoot. And I've had none of that, of course, this year at all.
Well, you bring us on to the pandemic, which no one can avoid that this year. But gardening has soared in interest. People have been drawn to it for all sorts of reasons, for health. I mean, health has been a huge driving factor, and I think will continue to be this uncertainty, obviously, over, you know, our health, our well-being, obesity levels and so on. So gardening is very much is an answer. But, you know, do you think gardening can ever be taken seriously by the medical profession?
I think it is beginning to be. I mean, I really do. Yeah. The answer is yes, I do. As part of a package, you know, I think that this idea of gardening being the panacea that is going to solve all problems is both untrue and unwise, because that, you know, it has to include, it's much more complex than that. But I think that more and more people understand, for both physical and mental well-being, that being outdoors, engaged in looking after other things, which for most people, the best opportunity are plants rather than animals, that has a rhythm of seasons and life, and sharing that in some form, either in some communal activity or with a family, or it could just be food. You know, you could just grow something and then share the end result, it's very nourishing and is really supportive of all kinds of other things that are going on. It makes people feel better about themselves. It gives people more confidence. I think the key to it is it doesn't take a lot to reset the switches. I think one of the problems with A, mental health, and B, modern life, is the switches all get turned the wrong way. It's not like you're shooting down. And if you can just reset them, reset the signals on the track lights, you then set off in the right way. You're actually not very far apart. You know, the two roads don't diverge very widely, except at extremes. But for most people, it's not a huge amount to make a bad situation A, tolerable, and B, actually okay, all right. And one of the things you learn as you get older, that okay is quite good. You know, okay is okay. It doesn't have to be perfect. It's never going to be perfect. That, you know, you are going to fail at all kinds of things, and you're not going to be Mr. or Mrs. Wonderful. You're not going to change the world, because the world is changing anyway all the time all around you. And that happiness is measured in cups of tea and birdsong and you know, a child, as a wonderful producer I work with on Real Gardens. I don't know if you remember that we did. And John Percival, and he died very sadly. And at his funeral, he had written a letter which was read out, basically saying, don't take for granted all those little things, because that's all there is. He said, it's the little dog. I remember this line. He said, it's the little dog wagging its tail absurdly jauntily as it goes down the street. And, you know, that image, that is a good life. That is happiness. And I think that's what people tap into when they go into the garden. It's the robin. You know, it's that first flower, the sweet pea or whatever it might be. And that's deep and profound and rich and wise, as well as being just a little something. And I think what the pandemic has brought out is that more people have suddenly said, oh, yeah, I get it. And I think that's all it is. The big question will be, is will it last? Is that an emergency response to an emergency situation, a kind of wartime response? Or has it click the switches or change the signals so that now people are on that track? And I don't know the answer to that.
We may find out, you know, next. Yes, I mean, you know, the interest levels are enormous, but seeing that through to next year?
I think the interesting thing is this relationship between horticulture and being outside in gardens and in the natural world. And horticulture can be intimidating, both in the amount there is to learn about it and in the horticultural, I was going to say establishment, because I don't think there's the conspiracy. I mean, I don't think there is anybody or any group of people. You can feel daunted by the whole establishment of the horticultural world, whether it's the trade or television or, you know, all the bodies that are involved. You, your magazine or whatever, me, and clearly that's not good, and none of us want that, and so we have a job to do to get rid of that. But I think that if the road in is, you know, anything from suddenly noticing dragonflies in the garden or the shape of the clouds or just the light that happens to fall at 7 o'clock in one half of your garden. That's gardening. You know, that's as much gardening as knowing how to take a cutting. And my bugbear with British gardening has always been the obsession with mastering technique and process at the expense of your human response to it. And actually, without the human response, gardening becomes like a fridge or you know, your sanity, there's a sort of the drainage system to your house. You know, somebody has to know how it works, but you don't need to use it. Gardening without poetry and without magic is dull. I think it's dull. You know, I mean, I know how to do all kinds of things in gardening, but they're a means to an end. They're not the end in itself. And I think what I hope is that people have come in sideways and got the magic without necessarily knowing about the process. Whereas I think the problem with gardening, certainly in my lifetime, and this may not be true anymore, has been you can't get the magic until you know the process. And that is just not true.
I think that is breaking down. You know, you can see it through social media, through Instagram, just those lovely images. Of course, we know there's a lot behind it, but actually people kind of really buy into that. So I think it is easing. I think things are changing. I mean, I guess I just was thinking we would end really about the future. Mm. Obviously, you've recently become a grandfather, and with, I'm sure, all the kind of well-being and all the pleasures of that. But, you know, will George, do you think, garden? And actually, more importantly, do you think he'll recognise gardening as being something more than a hobby? When he's old enough to garden, will gardening have attained a different sort of meaning for people, for individuals, and for society?
Well, obviously, I don't know. I think that he... I mean, one of the worries I would have for George in inverted commas, i.e. everybody who is one now, is that they will have access to an outdoor space where they can do those things. The thing I hope is that he learns to love the natural world and love the rhythm of the seasons and to be nourished by it and therefore want to nourish it. I don't worry too much if he becomes good at growing broad beans or roses. You know, I mean, he may not. I'd like to think that he wants to grow good food, because I think that's one of the important aspects of health, and you know, it's a particular interest of mine. But I hope we will be bringing up a generation of people who are aware of the possibilities of gardens as part of the rhythm of their own lives, rather than as a hobby, rather than as an optional thing. You know, when I was 17, it was so left field for anybody else I knew in my world that it was embarrassing to talk about it. And I hope that it's just completely inclusive and just sort of, rather in the same way that now maybe food is. You know, I think one of the wonderful things that people like Jamie Oliver have done is to make it inclusive and natural and normal. And my son's generation, sort of early 30s, are all good cooks. All, you know, they and their friends all cook really well. They know about food, they enjoy it, they like it. They're not frightened to really enjoy a fish finger sandwich or to cook a Moroccan dish or whatever. They're completely comfortable with it. And if we can get that with gardens, with the next generation down, then that will be wonderful.
Do you think it could happen?
I'll do my best, Lucy. I do. I think you have to have access. I think what lockdown has done has made people value their access to gardens. And we, you know, if population goes on increasing and we keep space, is not going to get any bigger, gardens are going to get smaller and is going to get less access to gardens. And that is the worry, is you need to be able to walk out into the garden in bare feet at 6 o'clock in the morning. And no communal garden will let you do that. You know, you need to be able to say, do you know what? I'm going to dig up the lawn. or I'm going to, tomorrow I'm going to plant this. And for that, you need to have privacy and ownership. It could be shared ownership. It could be temporary ownership, but you need to own that moment. And I think that has to get harder because we have less and less space. So I have no answer to that.
But I guess I know one area that we've been exploring on the program and through the magazine is increasingly houseplants and bringing life and that nurturing indoors. And I think you've been leading on that.
And that's been wonderful because suddenly you've crossed a boundary. You say, yeah, I want all that, but I'm going to have it indoors. I live in a flat, but I've got 43 houseplants. Every windowsill, every surface covered with it. I think that's absolutely wonderful and great. And in fact, that was quite difficult. That was quite a difficult bridge for me to cross because until a few years ago, I associated houseplants with not being gardening, with non-gardening. It was because gardening was about soil and outside and weather. And I had to unlearn that view and suddenly realize that, no, it's not. It's about connecting in the only way you can. If you've only got a windowsill, use it. And as you know now, I have lots of houseplants, that's something I've learned and I've picked up on. Yeah.
And we can see from the films coming through, the audience has amazing indoor spaces, whether it's green walls.
Well, some of the green walls have just been extraordinary. And they do. And I think that's also being driven by a younger age group. And of course, the beauty of being 25 is you have no fear. You don't care what Gardeners World say or the RHS or Gardeners World magazine or some boring old fart like me pontificating from a... You're going to do it because that's fun and that you've seen it and it's creative and it's the spirit, it's the world that made London in 1981, 82, 83 so exciting when we were starting out in fashion is because we didn't know any boundaries. We just did it. And it's just doing it that is creative and exciting. As soon as you have to start understanding the rules and what you can't do and shouldn't do, then it gets dull. And I think actually that to my astonishment, the most creative area in gardening at the moment is probably houseplants.
So there really is a good future.
There is a future. I'm not wholly optimistic. I think that there is always creativity to be expressed, how and where. I would hate to think that it was at the expense of being outdoors, because to me, there is this combination of earth and weather and plants is the magic that makes gardening so rich. So houseplants are one part of that equation, and that's a lot better than no part, but I'd like to see the other two in the mix as well.
Perfect. That's where the poetry lies.
And life without poetry is life in black and white.
Thanks for listening to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast. And you can find out more about the themes we've covered today at gardenersworld.com/podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell others about it and rate us in your podcast provider app. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify or Acast to never miss an episode. See you next time.